This is disc number 9.
The Sphinx played it out slowly, so there would be almost no time left before the deadline. He wants you frustrated and dejected and tearing yourself to shreds behind the scenes. He wants you to feel you have no choice but to release Sheikh Abdullah. "Fuck Sheikh Abdullah," said Carter with uncharacteristic venom. He quickly regained his composure. "Do you think Ibrahim was part of this grand illusion?"
"Ibrahim was the real thing, Adrian. Ibrahim was the answer to our prayers.
And you got him killed."
"You're tired, Adrian.
You haven't slept in a long time. I'm going to do my best to forget you ever said that."
"You're right, Gabriel. I haven't slept."
Carter glanced at his watch. 7 hours is all we have. 7 hours until an extraordinary young woman is put to death. And for what?" Carter was interrupted by the ringing of his phone. He brought it to his ear, listened in silence, then rang off.
"Robert Halton just faxed his letter of resignation to the White House Situation Room," he said. "I suppose the pressure finally got to him."
"Wrong, Adrian.
You can think of another explanation?"
"He's going to try to save his daughter's life by negotiating directly with the kidnappers."
Carter snatched up the telephone again and quickly dialed. Gabriel reclined his seat and closed his eyes. His head began to throb. A preview of coming attractions, he thought. Chapter 45. Paris, 2:17 p.m., Friday. There was a small internet cafe around the corner from the Islamic Affairs Institute, with decent coffee and pastries, and even better jazz on the house sound system. Yusuf Ramadan ordered a cafe creme and 30 minutes of web time. Then he sat down at a vacant computer terminal in the window overlooking the street. He typed in the address for the homepage of the BBC and read about the developments in London, where Ambassador Robert Halton had just resigned his post and offered $20 million in exchange for his daughter's release. While the news appeared to have come as a shock to the BBC, it was no surprise to the Egyptian terrorist known as the Sphinx. The perfectly executed operation in Denmark had no doubt broken the ambassador's will to resist. He had now decided to take matters into his own hands, just as Yusuf Ramadan had always known he would. Robert Halton was a billionaire from Colorado, and billionaires from Colorado did not allow their daughters to be sacrificed on the altar of American foreign policy. Ramadan watched a brief clip of the ambassador's Winfield House news conference, then visited the home pages of the Telegraph, Times, and Guardian to read what they had to say. Finally, with 10 minutes to spare on his 30-minute chit, he typed in the address of a Karachi-based site that dealt with Islamic issues. The site was administered by an operative of the Sword of Allah. Though its content was so benign, it never attracted more than a passing glance from the security services of America and Europe. Ramadan entered a chat room as Desmond 826. Kinky Kemmel 324 was waiting for him. Ramadan typed, "I think the Sword of Allah should take the deal, but they should definitely ask for more money. After all, the ambassador is a billionaire." Kinky Kemmel 324, "How much more?" Desmond 826, $30 million feels right." Kinky Kemmel 324, "I think the Zionist oppressor should pay too." Desmond 826, "The ultimate price, just as we discussed during our last conversation." Kinky Kemmel 324, "Then it will be done, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful." Desmond 826, "Master of the Day of Judgment." Kinky Kemmel 324, "Show us the straight path." Desmond 826, "Peace be upon you, KK." Kinky Kemmel 324, "Ciao, Des." Ramadan logged out and drank his café crème. "Ruby, My Dear," by Coltrane and Monk, was now playing on the stereo. Too bad all Americans weren't so sublime, he thought. The world would be a much better place. Chapter 46. Grosvenor Square, London, 2:10 p.m., Friday. The first calls arrived at the embassy switchboard before Ambassador Halton disappeared through the doorway of Winfield House.
FBI hostage negotiator John O'Donnell, who had been given just 5 minutes' warning of the pending statement, had hastily broken the staff of the Ops Center into two teams, one to dispense with obvious charlatans and criminal conmen, another to conduct additional screening of any call that sounded remotely legitimate. It was O'Donnell himself who assigned the calls to the appropriate teams. He did so after a brief conversation, usually 30 seconds in length or less. His instincts told him that none of the callers he had spoken to thus far were the real kidnappers, even the callers he had passed along to the second team for additional vetting. He did not share this belief with any of the exhausted men and women gathered around him in the embassy basement. 2 hours after Robert Halton's appearance before the cameras, O'Donnell picked up a separate line and dialed the switchboard.
"How many do you have on hold?"
38,
the operator said.
"Wait, make that 42, 44, 47, you see my point?"
"Keep them coming."
O'Donnell hung up and quickly worked his way through 10 more calls. He assigned 7 to team number 1, the team that dealt with obvious cranks, and 3 to the second team, though he knew that none of the callers represented the real captors of Elizabeth Halton. He was about to pick up another call when his private line rang. He answered that line instead and heard the voice of the switchboard operator.
"I think I've got the call you're looking for."
"Voice modifier?"
"Yep."
"Send him down on this line after I hang up."
"Got it."
O'Donnell hung up the phone. When it rang 10 seconds later, he brought the receiver swiftly to his ear.
"This is John O'Donnell of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. How can I help you?"
"I've been trying to get through to you for a half hour,"
said the electronically modified voice.
"We're doing the best we can, but when 20 million is on the table, the nutcases tend to come out of the woodwork."
"I'm not a nutcase. I'm the one you want to talk to."
"Prove it to me. Tell me where you left the DVD of Elizabeth Halton."
"We left it under the rowboat on the beach at Beacon Point."
O'Donnell covered the mouthpiece of the receiver and pleaded for quiet. Then he looked at Kevin Barnett of the CIA and motioned for him to pick up the extension.
"I take it you're interested in taking the deal?" O'Donnell said to the caller.
"I wouldn't be calling otherwise."
"You have our girl?"
"We have her."
"I'm going to need proof."
"There isn't time."
"So we'll have to make some time. Just answer one question for me. It will take a minute."
Silence. Then,
"Give me the question."
"When Elizabeth was a little girl, she had a favorite stuffed animal. I need you to tell me what kind of animal it was and what she called it. I'm going to give you a separate number. You call me back when you've got the answer. Then we'll discuss how to make the exchange."
"Make sure you pick up the phone. Otherwise, your girl dies."
The line went dead. O'Donnell hung up the phone and looked at Barnett.
"I'm almost certain that was our boy."
"Thank God,"
said Barnett.
"Let's just hope he has our girl."
She woke with the knock, startled and damp with sweat, and stared at the blinding white lamp over her cot. She had been dreaming, the same dream she always had whenever she managed to sleep. Men in black hoods, a video camera, a knife. She raised her cuffed hands to her throat and found that the tissue of her neck was still intact. Then she looked at the cement floor and saw the note. An eye was glaring at her through the spy hole, as if willing her to move. It was dark and brutal, the eye of Cain. She sat up and swung her shackled feet to the floor, then stood and shuffled stiffly toward the door. The note lay face up and was composed in a font large enough for her to read without bending down to pick it up. It was a question, as all their communications were, but different from any other they had put to her. She answered it in a low, evenly modulated voice, then returned to her cot and wept uncontrollably. "Don't hope," she told herself. "Don't you dare hope." John O'Connell's private number in the ops center rang at 309. This time he didn't bother identifying himself.
"Do you have the information I need?"
"The animal was a stuffed whale."
"What did she call it?"
"Fish,"
the man said.
"She called it fish and nothing else."
O'Donnell closed his eyes and pumped his fist once.
"Right answer," he said. "Let's put a deal together. Let's bring my girl home in time for Christmas."
The man with the modified voice listed his demands, then said,
I'm going to call back at 5:59 London time. I want a one-word answer, yes or no. That's it, yes or no. Do you understand me?
I understand perfectly. The line went dead again. O'Donnell looked at Kevin Barnett. They've got her, he said. And we are completely fucked. A Jaguar limousine was waiting at the edge of the tarmac as Adrian Carter's Gulfstream 5 touched down at London City Airport. As Gabriel, Carter, and Sarah came down the air stair, a long, bony hand poked from the Jaguar's rear passenger side window and beckoned them over. "Graham Seymour," said Gabriel theatrically. "Don't tell me they sent you all the way out here to give me a lift to Heathrow." "They sent me out here to give you a lift," Seymour said. "But we're not going to Heathrow."
"Where are we going?"
Seymour left the question momentarily unanswered, and instead gazed quizzically at Gabriel's face. "What in God's name happened to you?"
"It's a long story."
"It usually is," he said. "Get in. We don't have much time." Chapter 47. 10 Downing Street. 4:15 p.m. Friday. Graham Seymour's limousine turned into Whitehall and stopped a few seconds later at the security gates of Downing Street. He lowered his window and flashed his identification to the uniformed Metropolitan Police officer standing watch outside the fence. The officer examined it quickly, then signaled to his colleagues to open the gate. The Jaguar eased forward approximately 50 yards and stopped again, this time before the world's most famous door. Gabriel emerged from the limousine last, and followed the others into the entrance hall. To their right was a small fireplace, and next to the fireplace an odd-looking Chippendale hooded leather chair, once used by porters and security men. To their left was a wooden traveling chest, believed to have been taken by the Duke of Wellington into battle at Waterloo in 1815, and a grandfather clock by Benson of Whitehaven that so annoyed Churchill he ordered its chimes silenced. And standing in the center of the hall, in an immaculately tailored suit, was a handsome man with pale skin and black hair shot with gray at the temples. He advanced on Gabriel and cautiously extended his hand. It was cold to the touch.
"Welcome to Downing Street," said the British Prime Minister. "Thank you for coming on such short notice."
"Please forgive my appearance, Prime Minister. It's been a long few days."
"We heard about your misadventure in Denmark. It appears you were deceived. We all were."
"Yes, Prime Minister."
"We treated you shabbily after the attack in Hyde Park, but the fact that your name and face appeared in the newspapers has provided us with an opportunity to save Elizabeth Halton's life. I'm afraid we need your rather serious help, Mr. Allon. Are you prepared to listen to what we have to say?"
"Of course, Prime Minister."
The Prime Minister smiled. It was a replica of a smile, thought Gabriel, and about as warm as the December afternoon. They hiked up the long grand staircase, beneath portraits of British Prime Ministers past.
"Our logs contain no evidence of any previous visits by you to Downing Street, Mr. Lon. Is that the case, or have you slipped in here before?"
This is my first time, Prime Minister."
"I suppose it must seem rather different from your own Prime Minister's office."
"That's putting it mildly, sir. Our staterooms are decorated in early kibbutz chic."
"We'll meet in the White Room," the Prime Minister said. "Henry Campbell Bannerman died there in 1908, but as far as I know, no one has died there today."
They passed through a set of tall double doors and went inside. The heavy rose-colored curtains were drawn, and the Waterford glass chandelier glowed softly overhead. Robert Halton was seated on a striped couch next to Dame Eleanor Mackenzie, the Director General of MI5. Her counterpart from MI6 was pacing, and the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police was off in one corner, speaking quietly into a mobile phone. After a set of hasty introductions, Gabriel was directed to the end of the second couch, where he sat beneath the mournful gaze of a Florence Nightingale statuette. A log fire was burning brightly in the hearth. A steward brought tea that no one drank. The Prime Minister lowered himself into the wing chair opposite the fireplace and brought the proceedings to order. He spoke calmly, as though he were explaining a bit of dull but important economic policy.
At noon London time, he said, Ambassador Halton submitted his resignation to the White House and made an offer of $20 million ransom to the terrorists in exchange for his daughter's freedom. Shortly after 2 o'clock London time, the terrorists made contact with the FBI negotiators in the American embassy and, after providing proof that they were indeed holding Elizabeth captive, made a counteroffer. They wanted $30 million instead of 20. If the money was delivered as instructed, and if there were no traps or arrests, Elizabeth would be released 24 hours later.
So why am I here? Asked Gabriel, though he already knew the answer.
You are an intelligent man, Mr. Alon. You tell me.
I'm here because they want me to deliver the money.
I'm afraid that is correct, said the Prime Minister. At 5:59 London time, they're going to call the FBI negotiator at the embassy. They want a one-word answer, yes or no. If the answer is no, Elizabeth Halton will be executed immediately. If it is yes, meaning that you have agreed to all their demands, she will be released 48 hours from now, give or take a few hours.
A heavy silence fell over the room. It was broken by Adrian Carter, who objected on Gabriel's behalf.
The answer is no, he said. It's an obvious trap. I can think of 3 possible outcomes, none of them pleasant.
We all know the pitfalls, Mr. Carter, said the Director General of MI6. There's no need to review them now.
Humor me, said Carter. I'm just a dull-witted American. Scenario number 1. Gabriel will be killed immediately after delivering the money. Scenario number 2. He will be taken captive, tortured savagely for some period of time, and then killed. The 3rd scenario, however, is probably the most likely outcome.
And what's that? Asked the Prime Minister.
Gabriel will take Elizabeth Halton's place as a hostage. The Sword of Allah and Al-Qaeda will then make demands on the Israeli government instead of ours, and we'll be right back at square one.
With one important difference, added Graham Seymour, much of the world will be rooting for the Sword to kill him. He is an Israeli and a Jew, an occupier and oppressor, and therefore, in the eyes of many in Europe and the Islamic world, he's worthy of death. His murder would be a major propaganda victory for the terrorists.
But his cooperation will buy us something we have in exceedingly short supply at the moment, said Eleanor Mackenzie. If we say yes tonight, we will be granted at least 24 additional hours to look for Miss Halton.
We've been looking for her for 2 weeks, said Carter. Unless someone has made some serious inroads that I'm not aware of, 24 additional hours aren't going to make much of a difference.
Gabriel looked at Robert Halton. It had been more than a week since Gabriel had last seen him, and in those days the ambassador's face appeared to have aged many years. The Prime Minister would have been wise to conduct this conversation without Halton present, because to say no at this moment would be an act of almost unspeakable cruelty. Or perhaps that was exactly the reason the Prime Minister had invited him here. He had left Gabriel no option but to agree to the scheme.
They're going to make additional demands, Gabriel said. They'll demand that I come alone. They'll warn that if I am followed, the deal is off and Elizabeth dies. We're going to abide by those rules.
He looked at Seymour and Carter. No surveillance, British or American.
You can't go into this thing with no one watching your back, said the chief of the Metropolitan Police.
I don't intend to, said Gabriel. MI5 and the anti-terrorist branch of Scotland Yard will give us all the intelligence and support we require, but this will be an Israeli operation from start to finish. I will bring whomever and whatever I need into the country to conduct it. Afterward, there will be no scrutiny and no inquiries. If anyone is killed or wounded during the recovery of Elizabeth, no one from my team will be questioned or prosecuted.
Out of the question, said Eleanor Mackenzie.
Done, said the Prime Minister.
How long will it take you to assemble the cash?
Every major bank in the city is already involved, the Prime Minister said. The task should be complete by late tomorrow afternoon. Obviously, it's a large consignment, and therefore it will be somewhat unwieldy. They think it will fit into 2 large rolling duffel bags.
Gabriel glanced from face to face. Don't even think about putting any tracking devices in the cash or the bags.
Understood, said the Prime Minister.
It occurs to me that tomorrow is Christmas Eve. Clearly it is not a coincidence.
No, Prime Minister. I suspect they've been preparing for this for a long time.
Gabriel looked at his wristwatch. Can someone give me a lift to the American Embassy? There's a telephone call coming there in a few minutes that I'd like to take.
Graham will take you, the Prime Minister said. We'll give you a police escort. The traffic in central London at this time of day is really quite dreadful.
On the wall above John O'Donnell's workstation was a large digital clock with red numerals set against a black background. Gabriel, however, had eyes only for the telephone. It was a modern device with access to 20 lines, including extension 7512, which was available nowhere else in the building. Extension 7512 was O'Donnell's private reserve. Now it belonged to Gabriel, along with O'Donnell's warm chair and O'Donnell's wrinkled legal pad. The clock rolled over to 1759, and the seconds began their methodical march from 00 to 59. Gabriel kept his eyes on the phone, on the green light in the box marked 7512, and on the small crack in the receiver inflicted by O'Donnell during a blind rage early in the crisis. A minute later, when the clock rolled over to 1800, there was an audible gasp in the room. Then, at 1801:25, Gabriel heard one of O'Donnell's team members begin to weep. He did not share the pessimism of his audience. He knew the terrorists were cruel bastards who were just using the opportunity of the deadline to have a spot of fun at the expense of their American and Israeli opponents. At 1802:17, the telephone finally rang. Gabriel, unwilling to cause his audience any additional stress, answered before it could ring a second time. He spoke in English, with his heavy Hebrew accent, so there would be no misunderstanding about who was on the line.
The answer is yes, he said.
Be ready at 10 o'clock tomorrow night. We'll give you the instructions then.
Under normal circumstances, a professional negotiator like O'Donnell would have begun the delay tactics. Trouble assembling the money, trouble getting the permission of local authorities for the handover, anything to keep the hostage alive and the kidnappers talking. But this was not a normal situation. The terrorists wanted Gabriel, and there was no point delaying the inevitable. The sooner it started, the sooner it would be over. You'll call on this number? He asked.
Yes.
I look forward to hearing from you. Click. Gabriel stood, pulled on his leather jacket, and started toward the stairs.
Where do you think you're going? Asked Carter.
I'm leaving.
You can't just leave.
I can't stay here, Adrian. I have work to do.
Let us give you a lift. We can't have you wandering around London unprotected.
I think I can look after myself, Adrian.
At least let me rustle you up a gun.
What are you boys carrying these days?
Browning High Power, said Carter. It doesn't have the grace and beauty of your Berettas, but it's quite lethal. Would you like one magazine or two?
Gabriel frowned.
I'll bring you two, said Carter, and an extra box of ammo for laughs.
5 minutes later, with Carter's loaded Browning pressing against the base of his spine, Gabriel slipped past the Marine Guard at the North Gate and turned into Upper Brook Street. The sidewalk along the embassy fence was closed to pedestrian traffic and lined with Metropolitan Police officers in lime green jackets. Gabriel crossed to the opposite side of the street and headed toward Hyde Park. He spotted the motorcyclist 2 minutes later as he rounded the corner into Park Lane. The bike was a powerful BMW, and the figure seated atop it was long-legged and helmeted. Gabriel noticed the bulge beneath the leather jacket, the left side for the right-handed cross-draw. He continued north to Marble Arch, then headed west along the Bayswater Road. As he was approaching Albion Gate, he heard the roar of the BMW bike at his back. It came alongside him and braked to an abrupt stop. Gabriel swung his leg over the back and wrapped his arms around the rider's waist. As the bike shot forward, he heard the sound of a woman singing. Kiara always sang when she was at the controls of a motorcycle. Chapter 48. Kensington, London. 6:28 p.m., Friday. She drove for 15 minutes through the streets of Belgravia and Brompton, to make certain they were not being followed, then made her way to the Israeli embassy,
located in Old Court Place just off Kensington High Street. Shemron was waiting for them in the office of the station chief, a foul-smelling Turkish cigarette in one hand and a handsome olive wood cane in the other. He was angrier than Gabriel had seen him in many years.
"Hello, Airy."
"What do you think you're playing at?"
"How did you get here so quickly?"
"I left Ben-Gurion this morning after learning about your exploits in Denmark. It was my intention to ease your way through Heathrow and bring you home again. But when I placed the call to the station to let them know I had arrived, I was told you had just left Downing Street."
"I tried to steal some matches for you, but I was never alone."
"You should have consulted with us before agreeing to this."
"There wasn't time."
"There was abundant time. You see, Gabriel, it would have been a very short consultation. You would have asked for a clearance to undertake this mission, and I would have told you no. End of consultation."
He crushed out his cigarette and looked at Gabriel malevolently for a long moment without speaking.
"But to back out of this arrangement now is not an option. Can you imagine the headlines? Vaunted Israeli intelligence service, afraid to rescue the American girl. You've left us no choice but to proceed. But that's exactly what you intended, isn't it? You are a manipulative little bastard."
"I learned from the master."
Shamron struck another cigarette between his lips, cocked the lid of his old Zippo lighter, and fired.
"I held my tongue when you decided to return to Amsterdam to kidnap and interrogate this man, Ibrahim Fawaz. I held my tongue again when you went to Copenhagen and tried to negotiate with his son. If I had obeyed my first instinct, which was to bring you home, it wouldn't have come to this. You had no right to agree to this assignment without first obtaining the permission of your director and your prime minister. If it were anyone but you, I would bring you up on charges and throw you into the Judean wilderness to atone for your sins."
"You can do that when I get home."
"You're liable to come home in a box. You don't need to commit suicide in order to get out of being the next chief, Gabriel. If you don't want the job, just say so."
"I don't want the job."
"I know you don't really mean that."
"God, but you're sounding more and more like a Jewish mother every day."
"And you are providing me ample proof that you are not up to the job. By way of deception, thou shalt do war. This is our creed. We are not shaheeds, Gabriel. We leave the suicide missions to Hamas and all the other Islamic psychopaths who wish to destroy us. We move like shadows, strike like lightning, and then we vanish into the air. We do not volunteer to serve as delivery boys for rich Americans, and we certainly don't sacrifice ourselves for no good reason.
You are one of the elite. You're a prince of a very small tribe." "And what do we do about Elizabeth Holton? Let her die?"
"If it is the only way to end this madness, then the answer is yes."
"And if it were your daughter, Airy? If it were Ronit?"
"Then I would shake hands with the devil himself in order to get her back again. But I wouldn't ask the Americans to do it for me. Blue and white, Gabriel. Blue and white. We do things for ourselves, and we do not help others with problems of their own making. The Americans threw in their lot with the secular dictatorships of the Middle East a long time ago, and now the oppressed are rising up and taking their revenge on symbols of American power. On September 11th, it was the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Now it is the innocent daughter of the American ambassador to London.
And next, it will be us.
And we will fight them. Alone."
Shamron managed a faint smile of reminiscence.
"I remember a boy who came home from Europe in 1975. A boy who looked 20 years older than he really was. A boy who wanted nothing more to do with his life in the shadows. Nothing more to do with fighting and killing. What happened to this boy?"
"He became a man, Airy. And he is sick to death of this shit. And he will not let this woman be murdered because the Americans refuse to release a dying sheikh from prison."
"And is this man prepared to die on behalf of this cause?"
He looked at Kiara.
"Is he prepared to give up his life with this beautiful woman in order to save one he does not know?"
"Trust me, Ari, I'm not a martyr. And the only people who are going to die are the terrorists. When we lost Ibrahim,
We lost our only way into the conspiracy. Now, by demanding that I deliver the money, they've opened the door to us again. And we're all going to walk through it. Together.
You're telling me that I should think of you as nothing more than an agent of penetration?
Gabriel nodded. Taking possession of money will be a major operational undertaking for them. It will expose their operatives and their means of communication. And if they do seize me, it will expose some of their hideouts and safe properties, which will give us additional names and telephone numbers. The British and the Americans have agreed to stay away and leave it to us. We're going to fight them, Eri, right here on British soil, just the way we've always fought them. We're going to kill them, and we're going to bring that girl home to her father alive.
Gabriel paused, then added, And then maybe they will stop blaming us for all their problems.
I don't care what they say about us. You are like a son to me, Gabriel, and I cannot afford to lose you. Not now.
You won't.
Shamron appeared suddenly fatigued by the confrontation. Gabriel used his silence as an opportunity to close the door on the debate and press forward.
Where's the rest of my team?
They returned to Amsterdam after the debacle in Denmark, Shamron said. They can all be here by morning.
I'm going to need Mikhail and his gun.
Shamron smiled.
Gabriel and Michael, the angel of death, and the angel of destruction. If you two can't bring the woman out alive, then I don't suppose anyone can.
So, you'll give me your blessing.
Only my prayers, he said. Get some sleep, my son. You're going to need it. We'll assemble here at 9 in the morning and start planning. Let us hope we are not planning a funeral.
The apartment on the Bayswater Road was precisely as he had left it the morning of the attack. His half-drunk cup of coffee stood on the desk by the window, next to the London A to Z Atlas, which was still open to map number 82. In the bedroom, his clothes lay scattered about, evidence of the haste with which he had dressed in the moments before disaster had struck. Samir al-Masri's notebook, with his mountaintops and sand dunes and spiderweb of intersecting lines, lay on the unmade bed next to the woman with riotous auburn hair. A Beretta pistol protruded from the front of her faded blue jeans. Gabriel removed the weapon and placed his hand softly against her abdomen.
Why are you doing this?
She asked.
An insatiable desire to touch something beautiful.
You know what I'm asking you, Gabriel. Why did you agree to the demands of the kidnappers?
Gabriel, silent, deftly unsnapped Kiara's jeans. Kiara pushed his hand away, then reached up to his face. He recoiled from her touch. His skin was throbbing again.
It's because of Danny, isn't it? You know what it's like to lose a child to the terrorists. You know how it makes you hate, how it can destroy your life.
She ran her fingers through the ash-colored hair at his temples.
Everyone always thought it was Leah who made you burn. They seem to forget that you lost a son. It's Danny who drives you, and it's Danny who's telling you to take this insane assignment.
There's nothing insane about it.
Am I the only person to at least consider the possibility that these terrorists have no intention of releasing Elizabeth Halton? That they will take Ambassador Halton's money and then kill her?
No, said Gabriel. That is exactly what they're going to do.
Then why are we engaging in this folly of a ransom payment?
Because it is the only way to save her. They're not going to kill her in some cellar where no one can see it. They kidnapped her in a terrorist spectacular, and they'll kill her in one.
He paused, then added,
And me with her.
We are not shahids,
she said, parroting the words of Shamron.
We leave the suicide missions to Hamas, and all the other Islamic psychopaths who wish to destroy us.
Gabriel tugged at the zipper of her jeans. Once again, she pushed his hand away.
Did you enjoy working with Sarah again?
She performed better than I expected.
You trained her, Gabriel.
Of course she performed well.
Kiara lapsed into silence.
Is there something you want to know? Gabriel asked.
Whose idea was it for her to work with you on this operation?
It was Carter's. And it wasn't an idea, it was a demand. They wanted an American component to our team.
He could have picked someone else.
She paused.
Someone who didn't happen to be in love with you.
What are you talking about, Chiara?
She's in love with you, Gabriel. Everyone could see it during the Albacari operation. Everyone but you, that is. You're rather thick when it comes to matters of the heart.
She looked at him in the darkness.
Or maybe you're not so thick after all. Maybe you're secretly in love with her, too. Maybe you want Sarah watching your back tomorrow instead of me.
His third attempt to remove her jeans met no resistance. The cashmere sweater was a joint operation. Chiara dealt with the brassiere alone and guided his hands to her breasts.
Fraternization between employees in office safe houses is strictly forbidden,
she said through his kisses. Yes, I know.
You're going to be a terrible chief.
He was about to take issue with her statement when the blue light on the telephone flashed. When Gabriel reached for it, Chiara seized his hand.
What if it's the Mamune? He asked.
She rolled on top of him.
Now I'm the Mamune.
She pressed her mouth against his. The blue light flashed unanswered.
Marry me,
she said. I'll marry you.
Now, Gabriel. Marry me now.
I do, he said.
Don't die on me tomorrow night.
I won't die.
Promise me.
I promise you.
Chapter 49. Bayswater, London. 7:15 a.m., Saturday. Gabriel woke suddenly, and with the sensation of having slept an eternity. He glanced at the alarm clock, then looked at Chiara. She lay tangled in the blankets next to him, like a Greek statue toppled from its plinth. He slipped out of bed quietly and listened to the news on the radio while he made coffee. According to the BBC, there had been no response to Ambassador Halton's offer of ransom, and the fate of his missing daughter was still unknown. Londoners had been warned to expect heavy security along the city's main shopping streets and in the underground and rail stations. Gabriel took comfort in the weather forecast. Light rain, with intervals of brightness. He drank his first cup of coffee, then spent an inordinate amount of time standing beneath the shower. The cuts on his face made shaving impossible. Besides, there was something he liked about the look of several days' growth on his cheeks. Chiara stirred as he entered the bedroom. She drew him into the bed and made drowsy love to him one last time. They left the apartment together at 9:10 and climbed aboard Chiara's BMW bike. The forecasted rain had not yet started, nor was there evidence of the expected rush of Christmas Eve shoppers. They sped down Bayswater Road to Notting Hill, then followed Kensington Church Street to Old Court Place. A small knot of protesters was gathered in the street outside the embassy. They waved Israeli flags emblazoned with swastikas and shouted something about Jews and Nazis as Gabriel and Chiara slipped through the open gate and disappeared inside. The rest of the team had already arrived and was gathered in the largest of the embassy's meeting rooms, looking like a band of refugees from a natural disaster. All of Gabriel's original team was there, along with the entire staff of the London station and several other European stations as well. Uzi Nabot had made the trip overnight from King Saul Boulevard and had brought with him another half-dozen field operatives. It occurred to Gabriel that this would be the largest and most important office operation ever conducted on European soil, and yet they had no idea how it would unfold. He sat down at the conference table next to Shamron, who was dressed in khaki trousers and his leather bomber jacket. They looked at one another in silence for a long moment. Then Shamron rose slowly to his feet and called the room to order.
At 10:00 this evening, Gabriel is going to walk into hell, he said. It is our job to make sure he comes out the other end alive. I want ideas. No idea, no matter how mashugana, is beyond consideration.
Shamron sat down again and opened the floor to debate. Everyone in the room started talking at once. Gabriel threw his head back and laughed out loud. It was good to be home again. They worked through the morning, broke for a working lunch, then worked throughout the afternoon. At 5:30, Gabriel drew Kiara into an empty office and kissed her one final time. Then, wishing to avoid an awkward scene with Shamrone, he slipped out of the embassy alone and headed through the streets of Kensington toward Mayfair. As he crossed Hyde Park, he paused briefly at the place where on the morning of the attack he had come upon the body of Chris Petty, the American diplomatic security agent. A few yards beyond lay a pile of wilted memorial flowers and a crude cardboard placard of tribute to the fallen Americans. Then, on the spot where Samir al-Masri had died in Gabriel's grasp, there was a second memorial to the Hyde Park Martyrs, as the terrorists had become known to their supporters in London. Here was the coming clash of civilizations, thought Gabriel, played out on a few square yards of a London park. He crossed the open lawns at the eastern edge of the park and entered Upper Brook Street. Adrian Carter was standing next to the Marine Guard at the north gate, puffing nervously on his pipe. He greeted Gabriel as though mildly surprised to see him, then took him by the arm and led him inside. The duffel bags of money were waiting in Ambassador Halton's top-floor office, surrounded by a detachment of DS agents. Gabriel inspected them, then looked at Carter.
No beacons, right, Adrian?
No beacons, Gabriel.
What kind of car did you get me?
A Vauxhall Vectra, dark gray and unassuming.
Where is it now?
Upper Brook Street.
The bags fit in the truck?
We checked it out. They fit.
Put the money inside now.
Carter frowned. I don't know about you, Gabriel, but I never leave my wallet in the car, let alone $30 million in cash.
At this moment, the embassy is surrounded by 100 Metropolitan Police officers, Gabriel said.
No one is going to break into the car.
Carter nodded at the DS agents, and a moment later the bags were gone. You too, Adrian. I'd like to have a word with the ambassador alone.
Carter opened his mouth as though he were about to object, then thought better of it. I'll be down in the ops center, he said. Don't be late, Gabriel. The show can't start without you.
Precisely what was said between Gabriel Alon and Ambassador Robert Halton never became known and was not included in any record of the affair, overt or secret. Their conversation was brief, no more than a minute in duration, and the DS agent standing guard outside the ambassador's office later described Gabriel as looking damp-eyed but determined as he emerged and made his way toward the ops center. This time, the kidnappers did not make him wait. The call, according to the clock above John O'Donnell's workstation, came at 20:14. Gabriel reached for it instantly, though he remembered thinking as he did so that he would be happy never to speak into a telephone again for as long as he lived. His greeting was calm and somewhat vague. His demeanor, as he listened to the instructions, was that of a traffic officer recording the details of a minor accident. He posed no questions, and his face registered no emotion other than profound irritation. At 20:57, he was heard to murmur,
I'll be there.
Then he stood and pulled on his coat. This time, Carter made no attempt to stop him as he started toward the stairs. He paused for a moment in the ground floor atrium to slip on his miniature earpiece and throat microphone, then nodded silently to the Marine Guard as he exited the embassy grounds through the north gate. Carter's Vauxhall sedan was parked in a flagrantly illegal space on the corner of North Audley Street. The keys resided in Gabriel's coat pocket, along with a GPS beacon the size of a 5-pence coin. He opened the trunk and quickly inspected the cargo before adhering the beacon near the driver's side taillight. Then he climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. A moment later, he was turning into Oxford Street and marveling at the crush of last-minute shoppers. Carter's watchers followed him as far as Albany Street, where they photographed him making a left turn and heading north. That would be their last contact with him. As far as the Americans and British were concerned, Gabriel had now disappeared from radar. That was not the case, however, at the Israeli embassy in South Kensington, where, in one of the more bizarre coincidences of the entire affair, a group of well-meaning Christians had chosen that night to conduct a candlelight vigil calling for peace in the Holy Land. Inside the building, Ari Shamron and Uzi Naboth were holding a vigil of their own. Their thoughts were not of peace, or the holidays, or even of home. They were huddled round a smoky table in the makeshift operations room, moving their forces into place, and watching a winking green light heading along the eastern fringe of Regent's Park, toward Hampstead. Chapter 50. Hampstead Heath. 10:25 p.m. Christmas Eve. He parked where they told him to park, in the Constantine Road at the southern tip of Hampstead Heath. There was no other traffic moving in the street, and Gabriel, as he had made his final approach, detected no signs of surveillance, opposition, or friendly. He shut off the engine and pressed the interior trunk release, then opened the center console hatch and dropped the keys inside. A gentle rain had started to fall. As he stepped outside, he cursed himself for failing to bring a hat. He walked to the back of the car and removed the first duffel. As he was reaching for the second, he heard noises at his back and wheeled around to find a pack of young carolers advancing festively toward him. For a mad instant, he wondered whether they might be the Sphinx's watchers, but quickly dismissed that notion as they bade him a Happy Christmas and paraded obliviously by. He placed the second bag in the street and closed the trunk. The carolers were now singing, "O Come All Ye Faithful," outside a small brick cottage strung with holiday lights. A sign in the window read, "Give us peace in our time." Gabriel towed the duffel bags a few yards along the street, then crossed a footbridge over a set of sunken railroad tracks and entered the heath. To his right was a darkened running track. In the cement esplanade outside the padlocked gate, four immigrant men in their 20s were kicking a football about beneath the amber glow of a sodium lamp. They appeared to pay Gabriel no heed as he labored past and started up the slope of Parliament Hill, toward the bench where they had told him to wait for their next contact. He arrived to find it occupied by a small man with a frayed coat and matted beard. His accent, when he spoke to Gabriel, was East London and leaden with drink.
"Happy Christmas, mate. What can I do for you?"
"You can get off the bench."
"Is my bench tonight?"
"Not anymore," said Gabriel.
"Move." "Piss off!"
Gabriel drew Adrian Carter's Browning high power and leveled it at the man's head.
"Get the fuck out of here and forget you ever saw me, do you understand?" "Loud and fucking clear."
The man got quickly to his feet and melted into the darkness of the heath. Gabriel ran his hand along the back and underside of the bench and found a mobile phone taped to the bottom of the seat on the left side. He quickly removed the battery and searched the phone for any concealed explosive charges. Then he reconnected the battery and pressed the power button. When the telephone was back online, he spoke quietly into his throat microphone. "Nokia E50.
"Number?"
asked Uzi Navot. Gabriel recited it.
"Any recent activity?"
"It's clean."
"Text activity?"
"Nothing." Gabriel stared down at the lights of London and waited for the phone to ring. 15 minutes later, he heard a thin, tinny version of the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer. He silenced it with a press of a button and raised the phone to his ear. It took them only 30 seconds to deliver the next set of instructions. Gabriel dropped the phone into the rubbish bin next to the bench, then took hold of the duffel bags and started walking. At the makeshift command center inside the Israeli embassy, Uzi Navot laid down the headset of his secure radio and snatched up the receiver of his telephone. He quickly dialed a number for Tim's house, the riverfront headquarters of MI5, and 10 seconds later heard the voice of Graham Seymour.
"Where is he now?"
Seymour asked.
"Heading across Hampstead Heath toward Highgate. They just told him that if he has a radio or a weapon on him at the next stop, Elizabeth Halton will be executed immediately. In a few seconds, he's going to be off the air."
"What can we do for you?"
"Trace a telephone."
"Give me everything you have on it."
Navot gave Seymour the model and telephone number.
"I don't suppose they were foolish enough to leave any information in the calling history?"
"The phone was clean, Graham."
"We'll run it and see if we can come up with anything. But I wouldn't hold out much hope. Unfortunately, there is no shortage of jihadists in our local telecommunications industry. They are damned clever when it comes to covering their tracks with phones."
"Just give us anything you come up with."
Navot slammed down the phone and picked up the radio handset again. He grunted a few words in terse Hebrew, then looked at Shamron. He was pacing the room slowly, leaning heavily on his cane.
You're wasting your time chasing that phone, Uzi. You should be chasing the Watchers instead.
I know, boss, but where are the Watchers?
Shamron stopped in front of a computer monitor and peered at a grainy night vision image of four young men playing football outside the padlocked Hampstead Heath running track.
At least one of them is right there in front of you, Uzi.
We've had them under watch since before Gabriel arrived. No phone calls, no text messaging, only football.
Then you should assume that's what the Sphinx told him to do, Shamron said. That's the way I would have done it. An old-school physical signal. If Gabriel is clean, keep playing football. If Gabriel is being followed, have an argument of some sort. If Gabriel has a radio, take a cigarette break.
Shamron poked at the screen.
Like that boy is doing right there.
You think one of them is a spotter?
I'd bet my life on it, Uzi.
That means that there's someone else in the Heath who can see him. Someone with a cell phone or a two-way pager.
Exactly, said Shamron. But you're never going to find him. He's already gone by now. Your only option is to follow the spotter.
Navot looked at the screen.
I don't have the resources to follow four men.
You don't have to follow four. You only have to follow one. Just make sure you pick the right one.
Which one is that?
Eli has good instincts about these things, Shamron said. Let Eli decide. And whatever you do, make sure you get another beacon on Gabriel before he leaves Highgate. If we lose him now, we might never find him again.
Navot reached for his radio. Shamron started pacing again. Gabriel jettisoned the Browning and the radio in a stand of trees at the center of the heath, then crossed the levee between the Highgate ponds and made his way to Millfield Lane. Taped to the nearest lamppost was a snapshot of a dark blue BMW station wagon. The car itself was 50 yards farther along the lane, outside a large freestanding brick house with a string of smiling reindeer on the lawn. Gabriel opened the rear hatch and peered inside. The keys lay in plain sight, in the center of the cargo area. He removed them, placed the bags inside, then subjected the vehicle to a thorough inspection before climbing behind the wheel and tentatively turning the key. The engine started right away. Gabriel opened the glove box and saw a single sheet of paper, which he examined by the ambient light of the dashboard. Listed on the page was a detailed set of driving instructions, a journey that would take him from Highgate to a headland for the distant reaches of Essex, appropriately named Foulness Point. On the passenger seat was a well-thumbed Bartholomew Road Atlas. It was dated 1995 and open to map number 25. The drop site was marked with an X. The surrounding waters were labeled in red, Danger Zone. Gabriel slipped the car into gear and eased away from the curb under the watchful gaze of the smiling reindeer. He turned right into Merton Lane, just as they instructed him to do, and headed east along the edge of the Highgate Cemetery. In Hornsey Lane, a male pedestrian in a shoddy Macintosh raincoat stepped in his path. Gabriel put his foot hard on the brake, too late to avoid a minor collision that sent the pedestrian tumbling to the asphalt. The man bounced quickly to his feet and pounded his fist on the hood in a rage. Then, after reaching briefly beneath the passenger's side wheel well, he stormed off. Gabriel watched him go, then made his way to the Archway Road. He turned left and headed for the M25. At that same moment in Hampstead Heath, the vagrant returned to his encampment atop Parliament Hill. He spent a few seconds picking through the rubbish bin, as if looking for a morsel of something edible, then settled himself once more on his bench overlooking the cityscape of London. His thoughts were focused not on food or even drink, but on the four young men now filing over the footbridge to the Constantine Road.
"We think one of them is the spotter," Uzi Navot had said. "The Mamune wants you to decide." He already had. It was the one in the denim jacket, black high-top Converse sneakers, and Bob Marley knit cap. He was good for so young a man, but Lavon was better. Lavon was the best there ever was. He waited until the four men were out of sight,
then removed his false beard and tattered overcoat, and started after them. For the first 90 minutes of Gabriel's journey, the weather had held to a persistent drizzle, but as he crossed the drawbridge leading to Foulness Island, God in his infinite wisdom unleashed a torrential downpour that turned the road into a river. There were no headlamps in his rearview mirror, and none coming toward him from the opposite direction. Gabriel, as he sped past dormant farms and grassy tidal creeks, allowed himself to wonder if this would be his last earthly vision. Not the Jezreel Valley of his birth, not Jerusalem, or the narrow streets of his beloved Venice, but this wind-swept headland at the edge of the North Sea. 5 miles beyond the drawbridge, Gabriel glimpsed a sign amidst the deluge, warning that soon the road would end. For reasons known only to himself, he took careful note of the time, which was 12:35. A quarter mile later, he turned into an abandoned car park at Foulness Point and, as instructed, switched off the engine. "Leave the keys in the ignition," the voice had said to him in Hampstead Heath. "Take the bags out to the point and place them on the beach." For a few desperate seconds, he considered hurling the money into the car park and driving at the speed of light back to London. Instead, he extracted the bags slowly, then dragged them through an opening in the earthen seawall and down a sandy path to the narrow beach. As he was nearing the water's edge, he heard a noise that sounded like the wind in the dune grass. Then, from the corner of his eye, he noticed the movement of something black which, on a clear night, he might have mistaken for a passing moon shadow. He never saw the one who delivered a sledgehammered blow to the side of his head, nor did he ever see the needle that was rammed into the side of his neck. Kiara appeared, dressed in a white gown stained with blood, and pleaded with him not to die. Then she receded into flashing blue light and was gone. Shamron and Navot stood side by side in the command post, staring wordlessly at the flashing green light. It had not moved for 10 minutes. Shamron knew it never would.
"You'd better send someone out there to have a look," he said, "just to make sure."
Navot raised the handset of his radio to his lips. Yossi had followed Gabriel's beacon as far as Southend-on-Sea, and was sheltering in an all-night café overlooking the Thames estuary when he received Navot's urgent call. 30 seconds later, he was behind the wheel of his Renault sedan and driving at a thoroughly unsafe speed toward Foulness Point. When he turned into the car park, he saw the BMW station wagon standing alone with its rear hatch open and the keys still in the ignition. He drew a flashlight from the glove box and followed a set of fresh footprints down to the beach. There were more footprints there of varying sizes, along with a set of parallel grooves that led from the center of the beach to the water's edge. The grooves had been left by the toes of a man, Yossi thought, a man who was unconscious, or worse. He brought his radio to his lips and raised Navot at the command post.
"He's gone," Yossi said, "and it looks like they took him away by boat."
Navot lowered his handset and looked at Shamron.
"I doubt these lads took him into the North Sea on a night like this, Uzi."
"I agree, boss. But where did they take him?"
This is the end of disc number 9. Please continue listening on disc number 10.